Welcome to Science Matters. I'm Cynthia Ellick, your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today is Sunday, April 7th, 2024. Today, all eyes are on the sun, or so they'll be tomorrow. This year's total solar eclipse, which takes place tomorrow, Monday, April 8th, offers a rare opportunity for scientists. Today's first article and a feature in the latest issue of Science News, March 9th, 2024, focuses on totality, why this year's solar eclipse will be a win for spectators and scientists. All eyes on the sun. This year's total solar eclipse offers a rare opportunity for scientists, by James R. Riordan. And we see a photo of the moon passing in front of the sun over Wyoming during the 2017 total solar eclipse. I was there in 2017, and as you listen today, I am en route to Texas to hopefully see this year's solar eclipse. I will join 32 million people in the U.S. who will be inside the path of totality. In addition to that, there will be many like me who will be traveling to that path, camping out, hoping to see this year's phenomenon. Solar eclipses are dramatic events as a rule, but the total solar eclipse crossing North America on April 8th, tomorrow, is going to ratchet up the experience. Compared with the last total eclipse that crossed the U.S. in 2017, this year's total eclipse will last longer, the sky will fall darker, and the sun itself will put on a much livelier show. And millions more people will be able to step outside their front doors to see one of the most astounding astronomical events of their lives. It will also be the last major eclipse to cross North America for 20 years. All of that means that it's an especially rare opportunity for casual observers and scientists alike. A longer eclipse, a more active sun. The moon will be at a point in its orbit that's relatively close to Earth in April, making the moon appear particularly large. As a result, for anyone fortunate enough to make it to the path of totality, where the moon completely blocks out the sun's disk, the eclipse will last for nearly 4.5 minutes. That's almost 2 minutes longer than the Great American Eclipse of 2017. What's more, the sun will be close to solar maximum. That's the peak of its roughly 11-year activity cycle. As a result, lots of bright petal-like streamers of plasma will extend from the solar corona, the sun's outer atmosphere. The increase in solar activity also ups the chances of a coronal mass ejection, a large puff of plasma trapped in a loop of magnetic field that's blasted away from the sun's surface. A longer time to observe the eclipse and a more active sun will make it both a better show and a boon for scientists who have more telescopes, sensors, and satellites available to study the sun than ever before. Even viewers without other equipment should be able to see the streamers and a coronal mass ejection, if one occurs. Crossing North America. Nearly 32 million people in the U.S. will be inside the path of totality, says cartographer Michael Zeiler. That's about 2.5 times as many as during the 2017 eclipse. And the major East Coast metros from Baltimore to Boston are all about 200 miles from the path of totality, he says. That means that the path of totality is going to be very accessible to the bulk of the U.S. population, says Zeiler, founder of GreatAmericanEclipse.com. The eclipse will be visible to some degree in every U.S. state and portions of Mexico and southeastern Canada. The eclipse path will be particularly helpful for researchers who are using radar to study charged particles high in the atmosphere. Unlike the last two North American eclipses, this year's path passes within the observing range of a few radars in the worldwide Super Dual Auroral Radar Network, says space scientist Bharat Kunduri of Virginia Tech. Those radars monitor a gas-like plasma of positively charged atoms and negatively charged electrons in Earth's atmosphere, created when the sun's rays kick electrons off atoms. The plasma makes up the ionosphere, which can act like a mirror for radio signals and bounce signals from terrestrial transmitters back down to receivers, instead of letting the signals head out to space. That extends the range that transmitters can reach. The ionosphere also modifies the transmission of signals down to Earth from GPS satellites. Taking that effect into account is crucial for ensuring that GPS systems are accurate. During a solar eclipse, as at nighttime, radiation from the sun goes away, and the atmosphere becomes less dense and less ionized. Radio waves can behave differently, Kunduri says. Using the instruments in the radar network during an eclipse can help scientists better understand how the sun generates the ionosphere and how the plasma layer affects satellite and radio transmissions. An eclipse, Kunduri says, gives you an excellent opportunity to study what happens when there is a sudden change in the upper atmosphere. Spying on a coronal mass ejection. Because of the sun's elevated activity during this eclipse, the chances are unusually high that terrestrial eclipse observers and space satellites could have the opportunity to simultaneously study a coronal mass ejection. Both the European Space Agency's Solar Orbiter and NASA's Parker Solar Probe will be looking at the sun from the side while the eclipse is happening. That means that ground-based observers would be able to watch a coronal mass ejection traveling out from the sun, while the satellites would see the event head-on if they happened to lie in the path of an ejection and could take samples as the solar material goes blasting by. It's the only time in the lifetimes of the two satellites that the arrangement will coincide with an eclipse at solar maximum. If we would be so lucky to have one, says astrophysicist Noor Rawafi of Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory in Laurel, Maryland, and it's propagating toward the spacecraft, it will be fascinating to see it during a total solar eclipse. Scientists want to know more about coronal mass ejections because the solar eruptions, when aimed at Earth, can disrupt communications and power grids and potentially threaten satellites or astronauts in orbit around Earth. In addition to observing any coronal mass ejections, the satellite's observations could help confirm the source of particularly speedy solar winds, the stream of charged particles that flow from the sun, which seem to be accelerated by kinks that develop in magnetic fields near the surface of the sun. Insights into the solar wind, in turn, help explain how coronal mass ejections can affect Earth. That's because the ejections pile up material in the solar wind, which will affect the arrival time of these events to Earth. Knowing the conditions of the solar wind before the ejections is extremely important to predict when they are arriving or how potent they will be, says Johns Hopkins astrophysicist. Eclipse Day Science. Several experiments planned for 2024 are repeats from past eclipses. Some feature updated instrumentation. Others will benefit from observations gathered while the sun is near its solar maximum, allowing for comparisons to the more quiescent phase that the sun was in during the 2017 eclipse. All of this year's experiments should enjoy the improvement in data quality and quantity that comes with the longer viewing time. Take the WB-57F jet planes that carried instruments to observe the 2017 eclipse while flying along its path of totality. They will be in the air again in April, says physicist Amir Kaspi of the Southwest Research Institute in Boulder, Colorado. It's a big improvement because we are flying new instruments that provide better information. The fact that it's solar maximum will give us a lot more things to look at. Improved cameras and spectrometers, for example, will offer detailed views of the corona relatively close to the sun's surface. This eclipse is also twice as long as the last one. On the ground, it's 4.5 minutes, Kaspi says. In the air, we're going to get 6.5 minutes per airplane. If all goes well, he says, the instruments could also discover some asteroids thought to exist within the orbit of Mercury, which are difficult to detect without the moon blocking the sun's glare. Astronomer Shadia Habal of the University of Hawaii in Honolulu is leading a team that will fly updated cameras and spectrometers on the jets as well. She's also setting up ground-based observations at sites in Mexico, Texas, and Arkansas. Habal is even planning to send a spectrometer up to 4 kilometers aloft on a kite from a location near Kerrville, Texas, to get above any clouds that might block the view. The spectrometer collects light from the sun to determine the composition of material in the corona. There are changes in the corona that occur on timescales of seconds to minutes to hours, she says. So the longer duration of the eclipse also enables us to capture more time variable events and their impact on the corona and solar wind. Other repeat experiments include weather balloons that will measure waves of pressure in the atmosphere that ripple away from the passing shadow of the eclipse. And a redesigned spectrometer will ride aboard a Gulfstream jet chasing the eclipse over Texas. There's also a number of new or improved ways that amateurs and citizen scientists can contribute to the effort, including taking pictures of the event. An astronomical event to remember. Once this year's eclipse wraps up, that will be it for North America for a while. In 2033, Alaska will get an exclusive show in the western part of the state, which might partly make up for it having the worst seat in the House, as far as U.S. states go, this time around. Only a sliver of the state will be within range to see a portion of the sun covered up. After that, there will be an eclipse primarily over Canada in 2044, and another that will cross the United States and northeastern South America in 2045. While the astronomical event on April 8th will be both livelier and longer than many eclipses, Habal says that it doesn't diminish the importance of studying other eclipses. Every total solar eclipse yields new discoveries, she says. If you're one of the lucky tens of millions of people who will have a chance to enjoy totality in person, or among of the hundreds of millions within range of the partial eclipse, this is an astronomical event you don't want to miss. And a photograph caption reminds us that two of NASA's WB-57F jets will fly along the path of the eclipse on April 8, 2024, to extend the time that instruments on board can collect data and ensure the view isn't obstructed by clouds. We also have a graph of the eclipse path. The solar eclipse on April 8th will enter North America in western Mexico, crossing over Mazatlan, continuing over San Antonio, Dallas, Little Rock, Indianapolis, Cleveland, Buffalo, New York, and Burlington, Vermont, before it enters southeastern Canada over Montreal and continues northeast over Gander. This cover story and feature article appears in the March 9, 2024 issue of Science News. The writer, James B. Riordan, is a freelance science writer based in Maryland and co-author of Ghost Particle. From Advances, in the November 2023 issue of Scientific American, in the Department of Climate Change, zeroing in, supercomputer network could predict climate change effects down to the neighborhood. Scientists have used computer models to predict global warming's implications for more than 5 decades. As climate change intensifies, these increasingly precise models require more and more computing power. For a decade, the best simulations have been able to predict climate change effects down to a 25 square kilometer area. Now, a new modeling project could tighten the resolution to 1 kilometer, helping policymakers and city planners spot the neighborhoods or even individual buildings most vulnerable to extreme weather events. Climate science has always had a computing problem, says Bjorn Stevens, director of Germany's Max Planck Institute for Meteorology. Recent technological advances, such as shrinking transistors, however, have made computers far more capable, Stevens says. He and a group of climatologists and scientists from other disciplines are developing a network of global supercomputing centers called Earth Visualization Engines, or EVE, which they hope to complete within the decade. These centers would work together by running climate models, interpreted by machine learning algorithms, on supercomputers to predict climatic shifts and severe weather events locally. This international push, which organizers have called the CERN, CERN of climate science, could help municipalities mitigate disasters, say supporters who planned to present the proposal at the 28th United Nations Climate Change Conference last November. Higher resolution modeling could show how wind shear affects certain buildings, where floodwaters might go, or what areas are most vulnerable to damage. These details could inform measures taken before dangerous events, such as heat waves, hurricanes, or droughts, helping officials determine when and where to save water, set up cooling centers, or shore up infrastructure. Such fine-grained modeling may be enabled by a recent technological advance, a superchip called Grace Hopper, named after the pioneering computer scientist and developed by computer technology company NVIDIA. 10 years in the making, it could be used to process models as many as 6 times faster than other superchips while using less energy, says Dion Harris, NVIDIA's head of Accelerated Data Center Project Marketing. As EVE moves forward, that is the Earth Visualization Engines, Stevens and other planners envision making the data and models publicly available. Doing so, especially in developing countries hit hardest by the climate crisis, should be prioritized before rolling out new and expensive computing technologies, says Gavin Schmidt of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, who is not involved with EVE. There is a large amount of useful climate information that isn't accessible, Schmidt says. Climate modelers are trying to make the best of the information, get it out there, and help people make better decisions for adaptation. And this article was posted by Susan Kosher. Also in the November 2023 issue of Scientific American, in the Department of Medicine, catching it early, scientists develop wearable breast cancer scanner. If breast cancer is caught early, its survival rate is nearly 100%. If not, that rate can quickly drop to roughly 25%. Women older than 50 in the U.S. are advised to get mammograms every 2 years, but the most aggressive tumors often arise and are diagnosed between screenings. These interval cancers account for around a quarter of all breast cancer cases, and by the time you're diagnosed, it may be too late, says Kannan Daghaviran, a materials engineer at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. So Daghaviran and her team have developed a wearable ultrasound scanner that could be used at home to detect breast tumors earlier, particularly in high-risk people. Frequent screening is the key for survival, she says. Conventional and bulky ultrasound scanning machines use piezoelectric materials, which convert electrical signals into movement to send out sound waves that penetrate the body. Denser tissue reflects more sound, signaling the presence of a tumor. Scientist Daghaviran says she and her team miniaturized a scanner using a new type of piezoelectric material that performs better and requires less power. You get better penetration of deep tissue using lower voltage, she says. The researchers incorporated the scanner into a flexible, honeycombed 3D printed patch that can be fixed into a bra. The wearer moves the scanner among 6 different positions on the breast, where it snaps into place with magnets, allowing reproducible scanning of the whole breast. The scanner, which could be used once a week or month, was recently described in the journal Science Advances. The device achieves resolution comparable to ultrasound scanners commonly used in medical centers, but it does not have to be operated by a trained technician. If you have a wearable solution that individuals can use at their pleasure, you can capture a lot more data, says engineer Ruzbe Jafari of Texas A&M University, who was not involved in the work. That additional data can help doctors track a cancer's development and a treatment's efficacy. Dagdaviren was inspired to develop the device when her aunt passed away from breast cancer at the age of 49, despite regular screening. Just to comfort her, I sketched an ultrasound bra by her bedside, she says. It was a dream on a piece of paper, but now it's in my hands. She and her colleagues believe the technology could have a profound effect. With a very humble calculation, we found that this has the potential to save 12 million lives per year globally, she says. Clinical trials are underway in a bid for approval from the Food and Drug Administration. The device must still be connected to a conventional ultrasound machine to view the scans, but the team is working on a phone-sized device to analyze and transmit the data. Depending on cost, the notion of equity could also be addressed because you no longer need to pay for hospital settings, physicians, nurses, and so on, Jafari says. This device could be used in ambulatory settings, remote areas, and underserved communities. And again, this new scanner could help detect aggressive breast tumors early on, and the survival rate would be nearly 100%. This article is written by Simon Macken. From the Department of Ecology, bombshell. Turtle shells record ecosystems' nuclear history. The invention of nuclear weapons has shaped not only our planet's political history and systems, but its natural history as well. A study in the journal PNAS Nexus shows how scientists are examining the latter in a surprising place, the shells of turtles that lived near nuclear production and testing sites. The researchers detected traces of uranium in the shells of four turtles, including one sea turtle and one tortoise, that lived near such sites before being collected as natural history specimens between the 1950s and the 1980s. Using a mass spectrometer, a device that detects the material's chemical makeup, the scientists matched the signatures of uranium isotopes in the shells to the distinct signatures produced by nuclear production and detonation. Isotopes are varieties of an element that contain different numbers of neurons in their nuclei. In one of the specimens, they tracked the animal's uranium uptake over time by tracing isotope levels in individual concentric layers that form in shells like tree rings. Nuclear weapons are powered by the fission or splitting of uranium or other radioactive elements. The creation and detonation of such weapons shed these elements into the environment, where they are taken up into the local ecosystem. The shells that the team analyzed weren't technically radioactive because they contained such small amounts of uranium, around one part per billion, says study co-author Siler Conrad, an earth scientist at Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. The turtles had survived their nuclear exposure, and their health probably wasn't affected, Conrad says. Finding uranium in turtle shells is not necessarily surprising in itself. The element occurs naturally in soil, rock, and water. But Conrad and his colleagues were amazed that they could detect such tiny amounts of it and could match the isotope signature to a site's known nuclear history. Conrad hopes the study's new technique, which his team is adapting for use with plutonium, can help scientists determine where and when nuclear activity occurred, as well as how radioactive materials move from soil and water into plants and animals. He also thinks it could be used to trace exposure to nuclear fuel, in addition to weapons. For Laura Martin, an environmental historian at Williams College, the study is a reminder of the scars left by the U.S., its nuclear program, and not just in Japan, where the U.S. deployed nuclear bombs as weapons in World War II. Production and experimental detonations also sent radiation and other pollution into American neighborhoods and ecosystems, particularly in the West and often on or near indigenous lands, as well as in the Marshall Islands. This paper points us to how nuclear colonialism is not just a human history, Martin says. It has affected and continues to impact the whole biosphere. This article written by Megan Bartles. And some quick hits from science news around the world. In Antarctica, research stations in Antarctica have polluted surrounding ocean areas with heavy metals, fuel components, and carcinogenic compounds, a new study shows. The contamination has accumulated because of poor waste management over decades. In French Polynesia, thought to reproduce only at night, corals in reefs near French Polynesia were spotted doing the deed in broad daylight. It's unclear why, but researchers suggest this might help the species thrive in warming waters. In Germany, paleontologists in Bavaria unearthed the first complete fossil of a 150-million-year-old turtle. It had stubby limbs and a flattened carapace, suggesting that, unlike modern sea turtles, this ancient reptile lived along shallow coastlines. From Portugal, archaeologists found 3,000-year-old mummified bees in rocks off Portugal's southwestern coast, likely entombed by a flash freeze or flood. The insects were remarkably well-preserved in bulb-shaped cocoons. It's the first such ancient nest to be found with intact mummified specimens. From the UK, London's mayor, Sadiq Khan, successfully expanded the city's ultra-low emission zone to include all boroughs. The stricter standards on car exhausts have been politically divisive, but have led to a 26% reduction in harmful pollution emissions. And from the U.S., a Montana judge ruled that children have a constitutional right to a clean and healthy environment. This is a major victory for 16 young Montanans who sued their state, as well as for the growing movement for legal protection from damage related to climate change. These quick hits appear in the November 2023 issue of Scientific American and are written by Timmy Broderick. And now to The Science of Health, a monthly column written by Lydia Denworth in the Scientific American. This is from the September 2023 issue. Hearing aids may lower risk of dementia. Age-related hearing loss is linked to mental and physical problems. A friend recently noticed that she couldn't always hear her phone ringing or family members calling from another room. A hearing test revealed mild loss in high frequencies, which was possibly age-related. She is in her early 60s, and some difficulty with these frequencies often comes with advancing years. She didn't need hearing aids yet, but she says she'll monitor the situation and get them if the time comes. She was glad she asked for the test. Not many people do, nor do most doctors offer. It's not routine to screen adults for hearing loss, even though about 14% of Americans older than 12 have trouble hearing. The prevalence increases dramatically with age, to half or more of those over 70. Hearing loss often comes on so gradually that many don't notice. Others ignore it. Only an estimated 15 to 25% of adults who would benefit from hearing aids use them, and use is lowest among people who have less access to health care. Yet recent research has revealed that even mild or moderate hearing loss in older adults is associated with accelerated cognitive decline. People with hearing loss are more likely to develop dementia, and the likelihood increases with the severity of the loss. In 2020, a Lancet Commission on Dementia identified hearing loss as the leading modifiable midlife risk factor for later development of the disease. In July of last year, at the annual meeting of the Alzheimer's Association, Frank Lynn, an otolaryngologist and director of the Cochlear Center for Hearing and Public Health at Johns Hopkins University presented results from a first-of-its-kind randomized clinical trial of 977 adults between the ages of 70 and 84 with untreated hearing loss. One group received best practice hearing care, including aids, and another group took part in a program about successful aging. 3 years later, hearing aids did not make much difference to the healthiest participants, but those who were at the higher risk for dementia because of age and underlying health conditions saw a 48% reduction in cognitive change if they got hearing aids. When hearing loss is untreated, the brain's organization changes, says auditory neuroscientist Anu Sharma of the University of Colorado Boulder. In adults with mild hearing loss, studies show a decrease in gray matter. Sharma found early signs that vision and touch areas of the brain encroach on and repurpose underused hearing areas. Adults with hearing loss also show more activity in working memory areas. They need to make extra efforts just to listen, Sharma says, which may deplete cognitive reserves. Hearing loss is also associated with more falls, higher healthcare costs, and increased loneliness and social isolation. Hearing is fundamental to healthy aging, says Nicholas Reed, an audiologist and epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins, who worked with Lynn on the cognitive decline study. These consequences of hearing loss contributed to the Food and Drug Administration's decision last year, 2022, to create a category of over-the-counter hearing aids. Traditional aids dispensed by audiologists average $4,700 a pair and are not covered by Medicare or most private insurance. Most of the new OTC devices, over-the-counter, cost between $500 and $1,900. But quality varies a lot in this range. The high end includes customizable devices. Less expensive aids are preset with limited options, a one-size-fits-all approach that doesn't really fit all. Most users of over-the-counter devices still benefit from help getting set up and then troubleshooting devices. But setup help doesn't have to come from audiologists. In Baltimore, the Johns Hopkins Cochlear Center created a successful program of peer mentoring for older, low-income adults with hearing loss. It's too soon to assess whether the new devices will close the yawning gap between the large need for hearing aids and the smaller demand for them. In one survey, only about half of non-users said they would use hearing aids, even if they were free. It may help that popular consumer-oriented brands, such as Hewlett-Packard and Jabra, have jumped into the field. The key to getting around stigma will be the ubiquity of wanting to hear well and the sense that everyone is doing it. Lynn says, if wireless earbuds also became hearing aids, that changes the whole perspective of what it means to use hearing technology. And this report on hearing aids that may lower risk of dementia appears in the September 2023 issue of Scientific American. Written by Lydia Denworth, she is an award-winning science journalist and contributing editor for Scientific American. She is author of Friendship, The Evolution, Biology, and Extraordinary Power of Life's Fundamental Bond, which was published in 2020 by W.W. Norton, and she has also written several other books of popular science. The Sun is not the only celestial body in the news. From the February 10, 2024 issue of Science News, now streaming on Mars, future red planet explorers will need to connect with each other and us. Written by Payal Dhar. When astronauts land on Mars a couple of decades from now, perhaps they'll need to find a way to communicate with each other, with equipment on and around the planet, and with mission control back on Earth. Despite living so far from home, they'll no doubt want to connect with loved ones, keep their playlists up to date, or stream the latest episodes of their favorite shows. But setting up a Wi-Fi connection to Earth's internet won't be an option. Earth is simply too far away, around 50 million to 400 million kilometers, depending on where the planets are in their orbits. Spacefarers will need another strategy. Establishing a good communications infrastructure is essential for human missions to Mars, says Claire Parfit, a systems engineer with the European Space Agency, or ESA, who is based in the Netherlands. At the moment, we are in the early stages of working out what that means. Researchers are testing ways to upgrade existing networks, along with some far-out alternatives, for example. NASA's Psyche mission, which lifted off in October, with the job of exploring an asteroid between Mars and Jupiter, will also test interplanetary communication using lasers. Lasers could carry far more data than the radio waves that have been used from the earliest days of space travel. No known strategies can get rid of the time lag in communications between Earth and Mars. A message moving at the speed of light takes anywhere between 4 and 24 minutes for a one-way trip. In other words, a quick ping to mission control is out of the question, not to mention a WhatsApp call home. There's also the issue of solar conjunction, says Parfit, when the sun comes between Earth and Mars. This happens for a couple of weeks every 2 years or so, cutting off communications between the planets. The last one took place in November 2023. But new approaches could open possibilities that make communications on Mars more akin to what we experience here on Earth. At least one research team has wondered, what if Mars had its own internet? How communication works today. Several space agencies have landers, rovers, and satellites already at Mars that have to communicate with Earth. Consider NASA's Perseverance rover. It sends and receives two kinds of information. One is command and telemetry, where operators on Earth send instructions, receive information, and make decisions on what to do next. Percy typically receives over 1,000 commands from Earth every day. The second is the science data, pictures of Martian rocks, for example, that Percy collects. Percy, by the way, is the nickname for Perseverance. The helicopter Ingenuity also regularly pings the rover, which serves as a base station to relay data and commands between Ingenuity and Earth. Orbiters circling the planet, including NASA's Mars Odyssey and Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, or MRO, and the European Space Agency's Trace Gas Orbiter, or TGO, similarly send science data back home. A lot of the communication with Mars is routed through the Mars Relay Network in what NASA describes as a tightly choreographed dance. This network of five orbiters around Mars, MRO, TGO, MAVEN, Mars Odyssey, and Mars Express, transmits information via antennas pointed toward Earth. A rover that needs to send its latest observations back to Earth first passes the data along to one of the orbiters using ultra-high frequency radio transmissions. If that orbiter doesn't have a line of sight to Earth, it can hold on to the information until it does. The data are then relayed toward Earth, where powerful radio antennas distributed across the globe are always listening for pings from deep space. Once a human crew lands on Mars, this system will not be good enough. Vincent Chan, a researcher in fiber optic and satellite communications at MIT, doesn't foresee local, on-the-ground communication as a challenge. A Martian crew can interact using radio frequency and existing wireless technologies, he says. Two mini cell towers would be enough when the astronauts are close together, and a relay of some kind could be used when the astronauts are far enough apart that messages have to be sent over the horizon. People living in remote regions of Earth communicate in a similar way all the time. Those services are already in play, Chan says, and very economical. A big antenna on the crew's landing vehicle, pointed toward Earth, would probably be the very first infrastructure Martian explorers would set up, Chan says, but then things could get more challenging. When that ground-based antenna doesn't have a direct line of sight, astronauts could use orbital relays, akin to the Mars Relay Network, to communicate with Earth. Several orbiters would have to be available for round-the-clock coverage, and they'd need to be optimized for heavy data transfer. ESA is currently looking at making today's relay network more robust. It is in the early stages of considering a concept called the Mars Communication and Navigation Infrastructure, or MARCONI. If it moves forward, the project will develop a set of communication and navigation-related payloads that could piggyback on any mission headed to Mars. Once deployed into orbit, these payloads would act as nodes to provide radio communication on and with Mars, Parfit explains. They could then stick around for use on future missions. The more mass you land, the more expensive it is, so you wouldn't necessarily want to land massive communication systems on Mars every time. Though traditional radio frequencies would suffice for low data rates, using a laser link could carry 10 to 100 times as much data in the same time frame. Because of the higher frequencies of optical waves, hundreds of thousands of times those of radio waves, much more information can be packed in. Thus, this type of optical signal is just where space communication may be headed. The Psyche spacecraft, launched last October 2023, will test the feasibility of long-distance laser communications as it heads toward Psyche, the metal-rich asteroid it's going to explore. The spacecraft carries NASA's Deep Space Optical Communications, or DSOC, technology. Using lasers for space communication isn't new, but they have never been tested from distances farther than the Moon. In mid-November, Psyche beamed data to Earth from a distance of 16 million kilometers, 40 times farther than the Moon. In December, it sent a video of a cat named Taters from 31 million kilometers away. The European Space Agency is also exploring long-distance optical communications. One program called SCY Light, short for Secure and Laser Communication Technology, and pronounced Skylight, is supporting the research and development of optical and quantum technologies for secure and fast data communication from space. Despite the benefits, optical communication requires ultra-precision in aiming the signal. Unlike radio communications, optical signals are sent in a narrow beam that has to point exactly at the receiver. What's more, cloud cover and atmospheric effects also interfere with lasers. Any shift toward optical communications would mean some upgrades to the existing radio antennas that listen for messages from deep space, called the Deep Space Network, or new infrastructure. Though it's closer than Mars, the Moon offers learning opportunities for future connectivity. As part of the Artemis program, which aims to return humans to the Moon, NASA has contracted private companies to set up a lunar 4G network for telecommunications. Such networks are based on radio waves and would include installing antennas and base stations that can withstand the harsh lunar landscape. An ESA program called Moonlight invites private space companies to set up a constellation of communication satellites around the Moon, including for regions that don't have direct visibility to Earth. The first phase of the program includes the launch of the Lunar Pathfinder Orbiter, currently planned for 2026. Everything that is being done for the Moon, it's got the objective of taking humans and missions to Mars, says Thomas Navarro, who is based in London and is a future projects engineer with ESA. An ESA program called Moonlight invites private space companies to set up a constellation of communication satellites around the Moon, including for regions that don't have direct visibility to Earth. The first phase of the program includes the launch of the Lunar Pathfinder Orbiter, currently planned for 2026. Everything that is being done for the Moon, it's got the objective of taking humans and missions to Mars, says Tomas Navarro, who is based in London and is a future projects engineer with ESA. Those Martian explorers, not to mention future inhabitants, will no doubt want to do more than send messages back and forth. They'll want a setup akin to Earth's internet, which we use for everything from sharing photos to accessing massive databases. In June 2023, Tobias Pfanzelter and David Birnbach of Technische Universität Berlin proposed that a fleet of satellites orbiting Mars could provide the Red Planet with its own offshoot internet. Most of us here on Earth access the internet through our phones using radio frequencies radiation and on either wireless 4G or 5G networks or through Wi-Fi routers. These connections are linked via fiber optic cables around the world. The proposed Mars network would instead be similar to Starlink, a constellation of satellites in low Earth orbit operated by SpaceX. On Earth, broadband, internet, and mobile phone coverage via satellite is expensive, but on Mars, such a system might be cheaper and easier to build than an expansive and robust network on the ground. Pfanzelter and Birnbach are both experts in cloud computing, the delivery of computing services over the internet. For their proposed Martian internet, they extrapolated concepts from edge computing, in which information is processed close to where it is collected. Michael Clegg, a general manager at the technology company Supermicro, based in San Jose, California, has explained edge computing using the analogy of a popular pizza restaurant that opens smaller branches in more neighborhoods, since a pie baked at the main location would get cold on its way to a distant customer. Edge computing generally relies on base stations on the ground to store and relay the data, but low Earth orbit satellites are now being seen as an alternative. Pfanzelter and Birnbach concluded that a constellation of 81 low orbit satellites around Mars would be good enough for planet-wide coverage. They would provide a local communications system that would be an extension of Earth's internet. Consider an astronaut on Mars trying to catch up on a Netflix show. If you were to stream it from Earth, you would have to first wait 10, 15, or even 40 minutes, Pfanzelter says. And that's just to connect. It would be a frustrating stop-and-start affair. And if another astronaut on Mars wanted to watch the same movie, they have to go through the same process all over again. Instead, a cloud data storage system on Mars could make movies easy to access. You could just have the same experience that you have on Earth because all your data is locally copied, he says. Meanwhile, other uploads and downloads to and from Earth, such as science data, could continue in the background. Putting internet satellites into orbit around Mars would also be economical because it wouldn't require landing infrastructure on the surface. Landing equipment can make up a big chunk of a mission's budget. It would be much cheaper to just send a bunch of networking satellites to Mars and just keep them in orbit, says Pfanzelter. It's similar to a scaled-up version of the Marconi concept and could use radio or optical waves, depending on the state of those technologies. Even if arrival on Mars is decades away, Parfit says, it's not too soon to start planning. Live video chatting between planets is out of the realm of scientific possibility. Unless there is a major upheaval in the laws of physics, messages won't ever be able to travel faster than the speed of light. It's not a problem to be solved, it's just a problem. But other limitations can be overcome. Tackling those challenges may not only benefit future astronauts on Mars, but may also help get them there sooner. When you put in an infrastructure like that, Parfit says, you see many, many more missions being proposed. The author of this article, Payal Dhar, is a freelance journalist and author based in Bangalore, India. And this article appears in the February 10th, 2024 issue of Science News. And what do sharks on a golf course eat? Not cake, as we'll discover in this New York Times trilobite. Sharks on a golf course made a watery grave unlike any other. A group of bull sharks ended up spending 17 years in a lake by a golf course's 14th hole, suggesting that the predators can live in low saltwater environments indefinitely. This article, written by Annie Roth, was posted on September 12, 2023. For nearly two decades, the Carbrook Golf Club near Brisbane, Australia, had the ultimate water hazard, a lake teeming with bull sharks. It all started in 1996 when raging floods swept six young bull sharks from a nearby river into a 51-acre lake near the golf course's 14th hole. When the floodwaters receded, the sharks found themselves stuck, surrounded by grassy hills and curious golfers. The sharks spent 17 years in the lake, sustaining themselves on its large stock of fish and on the occasional meat treat provided by the club's staff. One shark was illegally fished out, while the others vanished after subsequent floods. The sharks, according to a new study, are more than just a fluke along the fairway. In research published last month in the journal Marine and Fisheries Science, Peter Gaussman, a shark scientist and lecturer at Ruhr University, Bochum, in Germany, said that the cartilaginous club members of Carbrook demonstrate that bull sharks can live indefinitely in low salinity aquatic environments. Bull sharks can be found in warm coastal waters the world over. These stout sharks can reach 11 to 13 feet in length and weigh upward of 500 pounds. They are one of the few shark species that can tolerate a wide range of salinities, a trait that allows them to venture into freshwater and brackish habitats, such as rivers, estuaries, and lagoons. Unfortunately, this impressive adaptation often puts the sharks in close quarters with humans, one of the many reasons bull sharks are responsible for dozens of documented fatal attacks on humans. If most sharks were to enter a freshwater environment, their internal salt levels would become diluted and they would die. But bull sharks have specially adapted kidneys and rectal glands that work together to recycle and retain the salt in their bodies. Freshwater and brackish habitats provide young bull sharks a place to grow up without the threat of predation from larger sharks. Once they've reached maturity, however, bull sharks usually head to the sea, where larger prey and breeding opportunities abound. That the Carbrook shark population did not grow during their time in the golf course offered further evidence that the species prefers to breed in saltier environments. While scientists have long known that bull sharks have the means to move between fresh and saltwater environments, no one knows if these sharks could spend their entire lives in freshwater. Research suggests bull sharks can live about 30 years, and the Carbrook group survived in the golf course's lake for 17. That suggests there is no upper limit to how long these sharks can spend in low salinity environments, said Vincent Rault, a postdoctoral researcher at Deakin University in Australia, who was not involved in the new study. I think a lot of people would be scared to learn that there could be bull sharks in their local pond, but the fact is, it's pretty amazing that there are animals that are able to do this, he said. While the idea of sharing a lake with bull sharks may be scary to some, the golfers relished the opportunity, Scott Wagstaff, general manager of Carbrook Golf Club, said. Every single member here just loves the sharks, Mr. Wagstaff said. When the sharks were still around, he and other staff would toss chunks of meat into the water and marvel at the way the sharks devoured the food with their fearsome maws. I've seen them jump completely out of the water and spin as they land. It was pretty cool, Mr. Wagstaff said. Extreme floods like the one that washed sharks in and out of Carbrook Golf Club are becoming more common, and more bull sharks could end up marooned in lakes, lagoons, and ponds. Although you are highly unlikely to encounter a bull shark in your local swimming pool, Dr. Gaussman, the shark scientist in Germany, recommends avoiding bodies of water recently affected by flooding. You should never bathe in stagnant bodies of water that once had a connection to the sea. You never know if sharks are living there, he said, although people in urban areas may not need to worry, as urban floodwaters are often too toxic to sustain marine life. And there's another lesson to take away, as shark sightings and occasional attacks on human swimmers prompt fearful reactions in some places. If this paper has shown anything, it is that it is possible to live side by side with sharks. Leonardo Guida, a shark scientist with the Australian Marine Conservation Society, said. This New York Times trilobite. Sharks on a golf course made a watery grave unlike any other. A group of bull sharks ended up spending 17 years in a lake by a golf course's 14th hole, suggesting that the predators can live in low saltwater environments indefinitely. This article, written by Annie Roth, was posted on September 12, 2023. And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ehlich, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'll be thinking of you all tomorrow, hopefully as I observe the eclipse with clear skies in Texas. Thank you so much for listening, and please join me again next week.